Hi, my name is Chris Brennan. You're listening to the Astrology Podcast. Today is January 27th, 2017 at 5:09 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is episode 96 of the show. Today I'm joined by Austin Kopic. Hey, Austin.
Hey, Chris.
All right. So we're going to do just the two of us today. Kelly is on a vacation to Australia and can't join us, but she'll be back next month for our next forecasting episode. So it's just going to be the two of us today. And like I said to you earlier, I think the sort of battle of the long-winded talkers will begin.
Yes, dueling monologues.
Right. All right. So let's see. Stuff we need to mention right at the top of the episode. So this is episode 96. Find out more information about the podcast, of course, theastrologypodcast.com/subscribe. So we're doing giveaway prizes over the next month or so. They'll be announced on episode 98 for patrons of the show who donate on the $5 or $10 tiers. Our grand prize that we're going to be giving away on episode 98 is a pass to the upcoming Northwest Astrological Conference, which is taking place in Seattle in May. It's going to be the best conference of the year. It's going to feature, I think, over 20 or 30 speakers for a 3 or 4 day conference with pre and post conference workshops. I'm going to be speaking there. Rob Hand, Mitra George, lots of other people who have appeared on the podcast will be there. It's a great beginner's conference, especially if you've never attended one before. And even if you have, it's always a great, great time. I think we were just talking about you probably making an appearance there this year, right, Austin?
Yeah, I think I'm going to make it up.
Awesome. And I'm going to try and I should have my book with me. I will definitely have my book with me by then. And I'm going to try to do a book signing and maybe a little get together or something like that. So yeah, it's going to be a big, big deal. So we'll give away the pass to that conference on episode 98 for patrons on the $10 tier. And for patrons in the $5 tier, we're giving away a set of CDs that contain back issues of the Mountain Astrologer magazine. They contain several years worth of back issues of the Mountain Astrologer magazine from the late 2000s with a lot of just amazing articles. So the Mountain Astrologer magazine, of course, is the premier astrological publication or publication in the astrological community. They've got forecasts, they've got elections, they've got great editorials all the time. It's a great publication, so check that out at themountainastrologer.com, I believe. So we'll also be giving away the free copy of that CD on episode 98. So in order to sign up, just become a patron of the show through Patreon, our page on Patreon, and you'll gain immediate access to that drawing. All right. Other news and announcements. So Kurt Kahn just finally finished the calendar for the current year, for 2017, for the Planet Watcher calendar. And so I'm using the image of it for this episode. So he wanted me to let people know that that will be available soon. So I think you can find out more information on planetwatcher.com. Otherwise, as soon as I have the link, I'll post it on the description page for this episode where you can order the poster for the 2017 calendar. Do you have any like news or announcements or things going on, Austin?
So on Saturday, February 4th, I'm going to begin a new year of fundamentals classes. And so the first year I taught it, it was 6 monthly units, and then I decided that synodic cycles were really key, and so then it became 7. And then this year, I decided that at least a cursory understanding of the most important fixed stars was fundamental to astrology. So now it's an 8-month course. and so, yeah, that gets going this Saturday, February 4th, and the way I've cut it up, because people are at so many different places in their study of astrology, and because a lot of people are self-taught to one degree or another, people have kind of patchy distribution of learning where they know this really well, but they never got introduced to that. And so people can go ahead and take the entire course and go with me for 8 months. Or they can sign up, they can drop in for an individual monthly unit. Like if you want to do traditional dignity and rulership with me, you can just do that. Or you can just do planets, or you can just do fixed stars. So it's it is created to be, you know, a logically constructed progressive 8-month course, but it's also constructed so people can drop in for whatever they're interested in or whatever they'd like to shore up. So that's a big deal. And then what am I doing? I'm writing. I'm writing every week.
Yeah, you're writing still like a machine.
Oh, well, I've started the machine has gotten upgraded. As of January, my Patreon hit the point where I'm now doing dailies. And so I'm now writing about every day in addition to every week and every month. And so those dailies come out on a daily basis, but for all of my Patreon subscribers, they just get a PDF file with every month or every day of the month on the first of the month.
Good times. Well, yeah, you're highly enviable sort of ability to really write prolifically. And I've been seeing that come through in the Patreon feed like every other day, it seems like.
Oh, well, thanks. You know, I actually, I switched up my writing regimen. Oh, I think it was about the last week of December, and it's gone so well, and it's actually easier than what I was doing before. I want to share this in case it's as useful for other people as it has been for me.
Right.
What I've started doing is once I get up in the morning and I drink my coffee and I do my Tai Chi, I then block out 2 hours where I do not go on the internet at all, and I'm not allowed to do anything except write. And I haven't, you know, this is, it not only is that area of time protected, I also do it before I've been sullied by exposure to the world. You know, before I've had anything, you know, because it's very hard not to react to the world, right? Positively, right. Negatively, you know, you kind of, it's like, you know, it's like having, you have a ball, and once the ball's in motion, it starts bouncing off of things and all of that. So, but anyway, I've been doing that, and it's been really good. It's less time than I was writing before, but I'm probably probably half again as productive, and it's less painful.
That sounds a lot more optimal than the routine that I fell into of waking up in the morning and just, you know, checking in to see how is the world ending today. It seems like it's what it's been like for a little while now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I, you know, that's, this particular structure is like the 30th that I've tried. You know, I remember when I was, writing the 2013 Almanac, I decided that writing was a job and I should just do it for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And that was this horrible descent into months long burnout.
Right.
And I started noticing that after hour four, the quality and quantity of the writing diminished radically. So I'm trying to skim the cream off my brain every day, and it's been working.
Brilliant. I will have to try that out at some point. I'm finally finishing up, and I'm excited to announce that the book will be out in February, probably in early February. We're trying to meet. We're basically in the middle of indexing the book right now, which means everything else, all 674 odd pages have been fully laid out and finalized at this point. And we're just trying to populate and index everything, which is a lot more painful and like time consuming than it sounds. Or actually, I guess that's not true, because indexing already sounds like it would be a very like painful and like time consuming endeavor in the first place, but I'm learning that it's actually much more so than you would even expect, especially when you're...
I mean, I think it does sound boring. You know, nobody ever says, hey, do you want to go indexing?
Yeah, I mean, reading through my own work, it's actually been kind of nice in the sense of just like populating different terms and then creating a sort of web of sort of references and like guiding people towards the preferred ones. And there's been something about learning the like philosophy, because apparently there's entire... I'm working with my friend Shannon Garcia, who does the layout for the Mountain Astrologer magazine, and she's the one doing the brilliant work laying out my book. But she apparently does indexing as like a professional thing sometimes for university press, and has recommended me like all of these books on index. There's like entire books written about indexing and like the philosophy of indexing, and I've had to like read a bunch of side articles in order to understand what I'm supposed to be doing when I index, and that it's not just, you know, a table of like every word in the book, but that there's like a structure and like meaning and a sort of purpose to what you're doing that's a little bit more complicated than you would think. So I'm learning that process, but we're trying to, I guess we're recording this on Friday the 27th, and her and I are trying to finish the book and have the final manuscript by Tuesday the 1st of February, which is coming up really rapidly, and I'm not entirely
I've
sure.
I've got some great news for you, Chris.
What's that?
Wednesday's the 1st.
Wednesday. Oh, that is good news. That gives me an extra day.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Wednesday, February 1st. Thank God. Okay, so we originally set that on the 17th as we needed two more weeks. That makes sense. So Wednesday the 1st is going to be our deadline, and I'm hoping to have a final version of the manuscript at that point and then submit it to the printer, and then they'll send me back a proof copy, and if that looks good, then the book is going to be ready and for sale. So I'm trying to get it out before the NCGR conference that starts on the 16th, and I'm actually going to be there in Baltimore speaking at that conference, so I want to have ideally a box of books with me to sell and maybe do a book signing or something like that at that conference. But when the book is available for sale, it's going to be available for purchase through my website at chrisbrennanastrologer.com, probably in the store section, so /store. If you want to receive an announcement, because I'll probably send out an announcement through my newsletter when it comes out, just go to sign up for my newsletter at chrisbrennanastrologer.com/newsletter. And yeah, I'm really nervous, but also excited that it's finally done and it actually came out really, really well. So I'll be excited to show it off and show everybody what I did.
Yeah. Well, anticipatory congratulations to you. That's a huge achievement.
Thank you. Yeah. It's a lot bigger than it sounds because it's something I've been working on for 10 years now, since like September of 2006, which is almost 11. So it's 10 and a half years. And then this year, especially, I sort of threw everything aside and stopped doing consultations and saved up a little bit of money and then have just been writing since last January, a year ago. So it's been a really intense year. I'm super exhausted and just over this entire process and ready to move on. But I'm glad to announce that I'm actually there and we're at the stage where I'm about to have a physical book ready for sale. So yeah. Good news about that as well is I'll also be able to start doing the podcast again regularly and doing my usual 4 episodes a month. I'm guessing not hopefully by the end of February, but probably not until March, but just listeners can sort of be aware that I will start doing that stuff again pretty soon. And once that's off my plate, you know, have a whole host of really great episodes and topics lined up to discuss in the near future. So, all right. You know, a lot has happened in the world since our last podcast, because we recorded the last one in like mid-December, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like it's been we're basically like a month and a half away from when we recorded that. And so much has happened. I sort of jotted down a list of like a few topics that I'd been building up, since I usually try to, you know, when I have something on my mind that I'm thinking about, because I've been doing the podcast for a few years now, I try to sort of set it aside as something that would be good for an episode. And I feel like I've got a whole list of those at this point, or at least list of like major events that have happened in the world that would have made for an interesting discussion on the podcast with you and Kelly. So maybe we could talk about some of that. Should we talk about that stuff first and just have our general discussion right at the front, or should we get into alignments and then have digressions as we go, or what are you thinking?
Oh, let's start with the past, and we'll talk about the astrology of the past, and I'm sure that'll lead us into the astrology of the present and the oncoming future.
Okay. And for those of you who want to jump straight to the forecast, I'll probably put the time stamp that you can jump to in the description for this episode. But otherwise, let's see. So what's been going on? One of the things that's happened so much in the past month and a half, and we're a little bit, it's almost a little dated at this point because we're like a month past when it was really being talked about so much in the news. But the whole thing about fake news, which we talked about because it was already being discussed heavily by mid-December. But one of the things I remembered basically after we released that episode that I meant to mention was, you know, one of the first instances of fake news that, all astrologers should be aware of that I totally forgot about was that whole astrology rumor that happened last fall, like around September, August and September, mainly, where suddenly the media and like everybody was talking about how the Zodiac had changed, and suddenly out of nowhere there was a new fresh Zodiac controversy for some reason. And all the astrologers were really bewildered about how this happened and why everybody was talking about the Zodiac having changed. And if you remember in that episode, if you go back and listen to it or even just read the description, I actually did some investigative work and tracked down where that story originated. And what I found really fascinating at the time, which now looks much more interesting in retrospect, is that it all came down to some sketchy looking sort of like fly by night blog that had written an article about this, and it cited some NASA page that had been updated earlier in the year. But this sketchy looking blog, it actually used some sort of statement, and it misappropriated some statement from NASA that NASA had put in one of its pages for like educating children earlier this year. And it made it out to be as if something new had changed, or that NASA had announced a new change that affected astrology and the Zodiac, when in fact it hadn't. And NASA ended up being forced to put out a statement to that effect. It all came back to this sketchy little blog, though, that was promoting that story, and then got picked up and promoted and passed all around Facebook, because of course Facebook had removed the human sort of oversight that it previously had, and instead tried to automate everything so that there was no quality control filter for any articles on Facebook past a certain point. So that's really interesting to me, because that's actually a perfect demonstration of what the fake news phenomena is actually really all about, at least what that term originally meant before, you know, to some extent people have been pushing back and attempting to apply that more to like the mainstream media or something like that. But using the original designation, that's actually a perfect instance of what that whole phenomenon was all about. And it's fascinating to me that the first sort of victim or casualty of that wasn't necessarily in the political sphere, but it was actually, you know, astrologers themselves had this really, you know, significant exposure or incident with that right away last fall. So I don't know, did you connect to that? I didn't connect that until later, that was really the same phenomenon or was tied into that, but I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, as we've noted before, and as a lot of astrologers have noted, that's been coming up on and off for a number of years. I logged into Facebook the other day, and you know how they have, they will show you something you posted 5 years ago? And it was a post that I'd written about, no, your sign hasn't changed from like 5 years ago. And I was like, that's funny. Yeah, like, that's what I'm saying. You know, I felt like that showing up in my, you know, in my history was, you know, barely in this decade history was a good illustration.
Sure.
Of that. But yeah, you know, the whole fake news thing, it's part of it. One of the things that makes me think about is this sort of, atomization, this horizontalization, this movement away from hierarchy, which characterized a lot of the 20th century and the 21st century, where, you know, as sort of stepping away from rigid towers and pyramids where like these are the people who are right and those people are wrong, or there's, you know, some sort of stratification of correctness, right? And sort of an institutional classification of truth and non-truth. You know, we have this sort of vast horizontal atomized fragmented thing where, you know, in the most extreme cases, everything is true and everything is false and everyone's an expert and no one's an expert. Because in some ways, I think that some of the fake news stories, that are blatantly fake are kind of reassuring, because we can know the difference between truth and, you know, falsehood or facts and things that are not the case. Right. But, you know, it's kind of part of our situation now where it's not like there's the news outlet that tells the truth and then there are the ones that lie, right? You know, we're in this in a sometimes seemingly impossibly complicated situation where there are 70 different voices describing the same phenomenon. We can maybe throw half of those out right away, but then we've still got 35. It's still a giant headache. And just in terms of the time it takes to research and consider the vast number of perspectives on any single thing, you know, it would be several full-time jobs just to keep up with everything. Pretty, you know, it's potentially very exhausting, but it's something that it's something that we make choices about because we can't not make choices, right? You know, the decision to not read any of the news or to read some of the news, or, you know, they're all there. We have all of these filtering choices. And it's part of the present, definitely. And that Saturn Neptune square, you know, it's what did it have? It had about a 13-month length, just described it beautifully.
Yeah. And it brought it to a head. While there, it's like, there's many of those elements that have been present or building up for a while, or possibilities, or sort of in the background, suddenly it all sort of coalesced in this really interesting way in multiple areas in the world. I'm sure there's a number of other areas where it came together that we don't even know about, or because we're not in those fields, we're not aware of that having happened. But I'm sure there's other fields where it was prominent like that as well. It's just interesting to see a really great example of it in our field, in the astrological field, you know, coinciding with that last one, which I think hit in August. But, you know, back to what you're talking about, you know, the issue now is, you know, information overload in the information age. And we're in this weird period of history where, you know, the internet and the amount of information that everyone's supposed to have access to was supposed to create, like, you know, in the most idealistic sense, or for some of the most idealistic people, maybe like the most intelligent or well-educated society, you know, possible or imaginable, because suddenly, you know, everyone has access to at their fingertips, like libraries and libraries full of information, more than anybody in any age past has ever had access to. But instead, somehow we're finding the opposite. And sometimes people are more sort of not knowledgeable, or more easily misled, or more sort of buying into falsehoods than you would expect than at other times. Because, you know, one of the things that's happened is, even though the internet's given everyone access to anything, it's also removed all of the, like, gatekeepers. That there used to be all these gatekeepers, on the one hand, both to accessing information, like, you know, there would be editors of newspapers and stuff who would determine, like, what stories met the standards or the qualities of that outfit, and they would reject ones that, you know, weren't good stories, or that weren't well researched, or what have you, and only let through those ones supposedly that met a certain threshold. So on the one hand, you have the removal of those gatekeepers to some extent, but then also the removal of others to the extent that now anybody can, you know, set up a blog, or, you know, even in my instance, for example, anybody can now publish a book, you know, with self-publishing becoming this huge thing and starting to become more, you know, not just a fringe thing, but something that's more mainstream and something where people can, you know, publish respected or legitimate works through that avenue. There's no gatekeepers there either, where in the past, you know, you'd have to submit a book to, like, a major publisher and hope, or a manuscript and hope that they accept it. And if they do, then you get your information out there, but it still goes through this layer of still having, like, editors and fact checkers and illustrators and design people and other people look at it. Now you have people that can just publish a book that can have whatever quality, it's completely under the control of the person publishing it. So there's this weird, like, theme of this sort of, like, the removal of gatekeepers to the distribution of information, but also the consuming of information. And it's interesting point in history, because it seems like societally we don't know how to deal with that at this point. And you have a lot of people, like the majority of society, that's good at consuming information, because we've been doing that for a while now, but not necessarily always good at, like, filtering out and figuring out what's, like, valid information versus what's not. That seems to be part of the other sort of underlying issue at this point as well, in terms of this whole phenomenon surrounding issues with the news, or issues with, especially with fake news and things like that.
Yeah. And even with real news, even with facts, you know, the thing about facts is facts are not the same thing as meaning, right? We can both look at a pattern of data and, or, you know, a room of us can look at a pattern of data, and one person can make an argument that it suggests things are going this way. The other another person can make a different argument, maybe not opposed, but another argument. There are, even if we all had the same facts and agreed on them, in many cases, there's still a variety of interpretations, not an infinity of interpretations, a range, certainly. But yeah, it's, that is the present.
Well, and the issue now is that we don't agree on the baseline. Like, there used to be, you know, I don't know, however many years ago, it seems like there used to be, like, you know, something like global warming, for example, you know, sort of agreeing that if, like, the majority of scientists say that global warming exists, then there's a debate about what's causing it and what do we do about it, or what are the best solutions, like, economically or socially or what have you. And it seemed like that used to be what the debate was, for example, in the United States, between, you know, both sides acknowledge that this exists, but we debate the best way to deal with it, as well as perhaps something about, like, how it's happening or how it's coming about. But now it's morphed into this debate of, we don't even agree that this is a thing, or that this is a topic of discussion that even requires debate, or whether it exists. And it seems like there's a lot of things that have morphed into that, where it's less about, you know, debating two sides to the same coin, and instead debating whether, like, the coin even exists or something.
Yeah. I think, especially with the United States, I often privately lament that there are so many real issues that we're going to need to solve, but we aren't even going to get to those. We have, like, I don't know, 10 more years of debating things that aren't even new or relevant challenges, or things that we really had figured out 100 years ago or 50 years ago. I certainly think that the Saturn Neptune square exacerbated what is part of our historical state. Right. Like, this is just kind of where the humans are at now. But that Saturn Neptune, square certainly, poured a little gasoline on that. And especially in the United States, because if you've looked at our transits lately, it's just not that good. we're going through a hard time.
Right. And speaking of transits, of course, I mean, the other thing that happened since our last episode, of course, was Trump was inaugurated. And one of the things that'll be interesting, sort of paying attention to what happens over to the country and just the world in general over the next few years, was there's, like, a statement that Ptolemy makes at one point where he basically, if I'm recalling correctly, says that the chart of the leader of a country becomes sort of like the chart of the country for the period in which that person is in power. And this is a concept that I talked about a few years ago, because I remember really distinctly seeing it in Obama's chart, because we knew that around the time of the 2012 election that Saturn would be ingressing into Scorpio, and that that was his 10th house. And so Patrick and I, in our prediction for the 2012 election, we said Obama will win, but he's going to have some problems. He's going to have a rough time for the first couple of years of his second term, because we were really focused on that Saturn transit through his 10th whole sign house through Scorpio. And one of the things that was really fascinating is, it wasn't really far into that term when the whole Edward Snowden leaks came out. And, you know, that I feel like more than anything really hit Obama and his sort of reputation on both sides of the aisle in a way that you hadn't seen during his first term, where people were pretty much, you know, generally or pretty universally sort of concerned or opposed to some of the sort of invasiveness of some of the sort of collection sort of practices that were disclosed at that time. And that certainly seemed to be one of the major things that came up that embodied the sort of sense of Saturn going through Scorpio of all signs at that time. But it was interesting how it it was also very much tied into that being a sort of Saturn transit through Obama's 10th house at the same time. So in that way, I felt like at the time that we almost saw like a real demonstration of that concept that Ptolemy talked about of potentially the chart of the president or the chart of the leader acting as sort of an umbrella chart for the entire country, potentially while that person is in power. It's going to be really interesting to see if that's the case, you know, with Trump as well. Like, and if you can see a noticeable shift and change in the dynamics of things just based on that chart, you know, one person's chart leaving and another person's chart sort of coming into power and setting a sort of stamp on the country in that way during that time period.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I think that the proportion to which I would read the country through the leader would be a function of how powerful the leader is in the country. You know, if when you're dealing with a Roman emperor type situation, like Ptolemy was, where you had vastly more power, you know, near unlimited power, that would make tons of sense to just be like, okay, that's the chart of Rome now. you know, they, even though, the executive office has been getting stronger over the last decade or so, decade plus, it's still, you know, not even comparable to a kingship or, the position of emperor, but it matters, you know, sure. It matters what he says affects stock markets, affects international relations.
Right. Yeah. And already we're seeing, I mean, the other side of that is not just the chart, but the, you know, just the transit, the transits at the time, sort of setting the tone for, you know, that time period. And I'm still continually amazed over the past few weeks at how much some of those transits, especially the outer planet transits, are still continually manifesting in really literal and straightforward ways. Like, especially the Saturn and Sagittarius stuff is just coming through like so blatantly that it's almost, I don't know what it is, but it's really blatant. So, you know, Trump signed an executive order, I guess, recently, as soon as he got into office in the past week or so, to build a wall between the United States and Mexico. And just that, you know, it's something we've talked about in the past, but even just that symbolism of Saturn and Sagittarius and building a wall between two countries is pretty, pretty literal, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and this is, you know, this is part of the, you know, the Saturn-Neptune complex that we talked about for most of last year. Which I abbreviated as waves and walls, you know, right. That was a huge issue in Europe with the waves of North African and Syrian immigrants, right?
Right.
You know, some of them were literally building walls. You know, it's this issue of borders. And as we also discussed with that Saturn Neptune square, Saturn was in the superior position. And so, you know, if we're going to summarize, I think, you know, walls won. The wall candidate won.
Right. And that's because Saturn in this superior position. I mean, yeah, it's that. I mean, and I mean, he issued an executive order stating that, like, people from certain countries couldn't immigrate to the United States anymore, which are largely from, like, Africa and the Middle East. He issued... there's like a proposal on the table to defund the United Nations or something that they're saying is more, even though it's been submitted regularly, they're saying it might have a better chance of going through than in the past. He signed a executive order pulling out from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is like a large trade deal that's had a lot of coverage over the past few years. Yeah, it's just been really, I mean, all of this stuff is stuff, you know, we've been talking about a lot over the past year, and that we've seen that were campaign promises that were sort of very much like, you know, fitting in the sort of zeitgeist of that transit, I guess, in some sense, in a very literal way. But it's really wild and weird to see some of this stuff actually happening now. Like, this is becoming like policy and law and stuff in the United States. In concert with, you know, the last year of this transit. So, yeah. And it's like, I'm not trying to get into like the politics of those and the morality or advisability or what that's going to do to international relations and everything else. But, just on a very basic sort of astrological or symbolic level, it's weird. I still have not gotten over seeing the literalness of some of the manifestations of some of these transits.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I think that we've gone from this, well, we've literally gone from a Saturn Neptune year where it's like, I don't know what's real. Are the Pokemons real or not? Is this person a real candidate or not? Right. And then we kind of found out, we got some clarity about what was real and what wasn't, whether we liked it or not. And now we moved on to a Saturn Uranus year, right? Literally, Saturn is back and forth in a trine with Uranus all this year, right? And so now it's surprise, right? It's like, well, I don't know what's going to happen, right? You know, Uranus, if we look at Uranus's signification, sudden changes, surprises, quick reversals, all this kind of stuff. When you know, once you're already inside a Uranus phase, right, then you know the unknowns become known unknowns, right? Where we're looking at like, well, he said that. Is that actually going to be a law? Is that actually going to be carried out? Mm-hmm. Is that going to be this? How long is this guy going to last? You know, and that's sort of where everybody's at this year, right? That's where the money is on, I don't know, like they say this, but maybe this, you know, but is it going to happen? And when it happens, what does it actually look like?
Right. Yeah. And that difference between, yeah, reality. That's a big thing lately. It's because it's been surprising. There's been a lot of people, like I noticed with like the Obamacare thing, where suddenly, you know, there's that whole trending Twitter thing of people that are saying like, that are surprised that they might be losing healthcare or something because they thought that the Affordable Care Act was different than Obamacare. And now they're mad at Trump for potentially taking away their healthcare, even though that was something he said on the campaign trail that like he was going to repeal Obamacare. And that was one of his sort of core campaign promises. And it's interesting seeing that dynamic, but seeing also the dynamic of just like of Mercury Neptune squares, which is something that I've had this real issue, like that's been one of the aspects that I've always had a big issue with because of interactions with certain characters in my past that had like Mercury square Neptune as a really prominent thing, where I don't know how to explain this, but like back when I was living in Maryland, where I knew somebody who just like would constantly say that, you know, he was in the process of finishing some project and he was just about to release it, but then he never did. And he kept saying that for like 2 years, but he would always, when you talk to him in person, like he would always be so, he would appear to look so genuine when he said it, that it was really easy to take his word for it. And you're really inclined to sort of buy like whatever he was saying. But then you'd really, like, after a period of time, you'd have to realize that you couldn't listen to what the person was saying, that you'd have to look at what he was actually doing and what his actions were, and that his actions were frequently, you know, very different than what he was saying, and that at some point you had to stop paying attention to the words entirely and instead just focus on the actions. And I think that's going to be an interesting, you know, to some extent, because the past two U.S. presidents have had that aspect, have had Mercury square Neptune. And so to some extent, this is a sort of continuing theme, or at least something that you could say that people were doing or should have been doing in the last presidency. But it seems like that's also something I found it humorous that the media has started saying this in this instance, that you have to pay more attention in some instances to what Trump does versus what he says or what the promises are necessarily, because sometimes he might find it harder to carry things out in actuality versus, you know, what is promised, just in terms of, you know, how politics are done and getting things done in Washington and things like that. And that's been interesting to me just because I've had like a real personal experience with that in the past of people that have Mercury Neptune sort of in a tight square when it is under certain conditions, that can sometimes be an issue in terms of that divergence between, you know, what a person says versus what a person does. So that's going to be an interesting sort of continuing theme this year as well. And I'll be curious if that continues to be sort of in the news, or if we see that become sort of more prominent in some ways, despite the fact that eventually once Saturn leaves you know, Sagittarius eventually by December, I guess, will get out of this whole Saturn square Neptune phase. But whether that won't continue to sort of be an issue here in the next, I don't know, a few months. Is that like verging too? We're trying to be careful here, but is that verging like too close to like being political or having too much of a political discussion?
I don't know.
All right.
I really don't want to talk about Trump anymore. That's all I ever hear about. It's all that's ever on any news ever.
Yeah. And I didn't mean to get tied into it too much. I guess it's just that there's been such a long space of like a month and a half since we did the last episode. And that's pretty much what's been dominating the news. It's just been all of this stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that I think is funny is that what happened was exactly what you would have expected to happen. The person got elected and then they got inaugurated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing that I think is, that is interesting, was the Women's March. It was the day after inauguration, mm-hmm. Saturday. And, it was, I believe the largest protest day in American history. And one thing that I think was really interesting about that astrologically is that one of the main players in this year's astrology is the pairing of Uranus and Neptune. The opposition of Jupiter and Uranus. Jupiter is in Leo. I can't talk. Jupiter is in Libra and Uranus is in Aries, and the two are scheduled to have already made one perfect opposition, which they did at the end of December, and are going to make another perfect opposition here at the end of this month. And then they make another one. And so what's interesting about Jupiter Uranus, if we just do really brief history, is they seem to be fantastic for protest movements. The last one was in 2010, and that saw the birth of both the Occupy movement, as well as the Tea Party, both of which were protests against the way things are. And so now, a week ago, with Jupiter and Uranus pretty much exactly opposed to one another, we have protest and opposition on a historic scale. And so because that's one of the features of this year, that's interesting. And that one just came along, right? That one just started at the end of December and nobody saw that coming. You know, people are like, oh, some people show up. A lot of the estimated numbers were like a fifth or a tenth of the people who actually attended.
Right. That is really interesting. So it was tied into the conjunction. So that was in like Aries, the Jupiter Uranus conjunction in 2010, right?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
And so now, you know, if we're reading, if we're using the lunar cycle as a sort of template for other synodic cycles, other paired cycles like that, you know, the Jupiter Uranus conjunction is kind of like the new moon. And then the Jupiter Uranus opposition, which we're in all year, is the full moon. So we just entered the full moon phase.
Right. Yeah. And that's the same with like the Saturn Neptune square that we've been talking about so much. I've really been meaning to go back and look at more into like the late 80s at the Saturn Neptune conjunction, back then, especially, to understand some of this cycle that we're going through, because whatever's playing right out right now, that's happening in the Saturn Neptune square, is something that the seeds of which, or the foundation of which, was probably laid back then in the 1980s. I mean, I'm sure you've looked into that more than I have.
Yeah, a little bit. One of the things I looked into with the Saturn Neptune square is the last time we had the Saturn Superior Neptune square, mm-hmm. Was in the late, it was the end of the Carter administration. And so that was interesting because that was, we did a switch from Carter to Reagan under that one. And so we have, you know, and we, you know, we have a, there was a, it, oh God, it's just impossible not to talk about politics.
Right.
but yes, that was, Saturn Neptune, 79, 80. I happen to know that because that's in my chart, because I was born in 79.
Oh, right. Okay. I mean, one more thing, and we can get off politics completely, but one of the things I was thinking about, and it's less fresh in my mind, but like a week or two ago, I was thinking about this issue of like bias in prediction or bias in astrological predictions in particular, because that was one of the things that people immediately jumped to. And a lot of, there's a lot of accusations made against, you know, the people like myself that got it wrong in November that predicted the election wrong, about this sort of assumption that it was just about political bias and assuming that that all the liberal astrologers predicted that Trump would, that Hillary would win, and all the conservatives predicted the opposite. But that wasn't necessarily the case. I mean, there was a bit of a breakdown like that in terms of most of the people that got it, the small group of people that got it right were conservatives. And so, you know, the people that were voting for Trump predicted that Trump would win, but the much larger group of at least, I want to say 80%, 85%, maybe higher, that predicted that Hillary would win, that was a pretty mixed group. And while it's true that there are more liberals probably in the astrological community, as probably as a holdover from the New Age movement or the hippies that came in the 1960s and 70s, there's a lot more conservatives in the astrological community than sometimes it's assumed. And I know a number of conservatives that did predict that Hillary would win. So it's not immediately like just something where you can say that the bias was political. The issue when it comes to bias that's more relevant is actually that astrologer, it's about the context of astrological predictions and how astrological predictions are made, and something that astrologers learn very quickly and very early on in studying astrology and in trying to anticipate or make predictions about what will happen in the future based on astrology. Something that you learn very quickly is that all predictions have, they occur within the realm of what's possible and what's probable, which is a separate sort of practical consideration that's taken into place, and it becomes sort of the lens through which you look at the astrology in terms of what's possible or what's probable. So like an example of that is like, let's say somebody gives you a chart and they say, you know, predict when this person will become president. And you look at the chart, and the chart's, you know, using some eminence techniques, it indicates that the person would become president in like 2050 or in 50 years. And so you say that, and then they say, well, this is the chart of a turtle, of the birth chart of a turtle. And so right away, you know, then from the context of that, that that's not possible for that turtle in all likelihood to become president. You know, barring, I mean, stranger things, I guess I should qualify that statement, because who knows at this point, but you know, in all reality, that turtle's probably not going to become president. And so the context of that prediction right away would be changed, or the astrologer would moderate it based on their knowledge, their sort of like practical knowledge of what's plausible within the context of that entity, right?
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier, and I gave an example of looking at a client's chart and looking at some eighth house action. And so the eighth house is the house, is the primary house, which you use to look at death. But every time, for example, the sun transits a person's eighth house, you don't assume that they're going to die, right? Nobody right. would make it to, you know, to age one. If that was the case, you're like, well, you know, the eighth house means other things too. I bet that's what, you know, that's what we're going to be dealing with.
Yeah. So it's like, even though that is the thing that you would look at or expect to see in the event of that being the outcome, that's not most of the time typically going to be the outcome. So that's, it's like you handicap it. And I don't know if that's the right terminology to use. It's like golfers use that terminology of like handicapping something. And I'm not a golfer, so I'm not sure if that's the correct one, but it sounds vaguely right. I don't know. Are you golf?
My dad made me golf when I was like 10. All right. I don't remember what my handicap was.
So it's just this idea. I mean, as I'd apply it in this analogy, just that, you know, there's a higher threshold for something, based on the probability that there might be a higher threshold for what you would need to see in order to predict something was going to happen, versus if something else is more likely from a practical standpoint, you might have a lower threshold of what needs to show up in order to assume that that's going to be the probable outcome. so that there's this like waiting almost that takes place. And that happens sort of universally, I think, in all astrological predictions and all predictive work using astrology. It's just something that's not talked about very much, just because basically very few discussions ever get to like that level of like the philosophy of astrology. So it's just not something that's been discussed a lot, I guess, or explored a lot in the astrological community.
Yeah. Nobody predicts what they think is impossible.
Right. I mean, well, and that's one of the funny things is like very early on in astrology, that's usually a lesson that people probably do learn the hard way by predicting things that aren't possible or, you know, so maybe that's sort of overstating the point, but that all astrologers probably do have an experience at some point where, you know, there's something that could happen, but it's very unlikely. And they make a prediction saying that thing will happen, or the opposite, saying that that thing won't happen. But I guess you just learn very quickly once you get into astrology that even though there's this huge realm of possibilities based on the astrological placements, that all of that has to be looked at within the context of what's possible, what's practical, or what's likely. I guess.
Yeah, I think there's another common example of that is when people first get into astrology and start working it, they tend to predict the more dramatic version of events.
Right.
You know, it's like there's this once in a lifetime Saturn Uranus Neptune conjunction on top of a person's sun.
Right.
And so, you know, you're like, oh, this is going to be crazy. And, you know, it's a little weird and some stuff happens and you can see the planet's natures, right? But for most people, it's not this world changing thing. You know, for like the five musicians, who happened to have super, you know, write super popular hits when that happened, it was a big thing. People will look at something that's dramatic and that's going to be dramatic for that person's life. Right.
Right.
Or that'll be, you know, that'll be, a deviation from the norm. But, you know, you make a few, or you look at your own chart, you're like, oh, this is going to be so awesome. That's going to happen. And it's like pretty good, you know? And so I think, most professional astrologers kind of learn to rein in expectations. They pull it away from extremes and, you know, sort of look at, you know, look at the less dramatic version of things, which is a way of, confining things to the probable.
Well, and it's something that comes up personally, I think, for a lot of astrologers regularly as well, specifically in the context of like if you see a negative or potentially negative transit coming up in your chart, and sometimes there can be this sort of apprehension of like, oh, I've got this, you know, really heavy transit coming up. And you sort of think of what some of the worst case scenarios could be, and somewhere in the back of your mind, in the lead up to that or right when it starts happening, you're sort of on edge about not knowing if the worst case scenario is going to happen. But then more often than not, what happens, something comes up and it's like moderately unpleasant or annoying or challenging to work through, but it's otherwise something that comes and goes and it's not the end of the world. And it's like that happens enough times at some point that you realize that you know, even for what look like really negative transits, you've got to moderate that and be a little bit careful in terms of jumping to the conclusion that the extreme will be the case. And when you do that, that does have the effect of building in, you know, sort of like a handicapped or a weighting to your prediction based on past experience in terms of when the probability of things sometimes wins out versus what the worst case scenario is of the astrology wins out.
Yeah, well, it's sort of like the 80-20 rule. You know, you want to go with the, you know, the 80% of probabilities that are likely, and you chop off that extreme 20%. And so, you know, that means that you won't be right 100% of the time unless you're, you know, absolutely divine in your astrology. But, you know, like you've chosen 80 over 20, right? You're not assuming that the, you know, the extreme end of the spectrum is going to be the case.
Right. So I bring all this up because that, you know, this is something where when I did my sort of post-election podcast in November, after I like thought about it for a week and then, you know, just decided to talk for a solo show for 2 or 3 hours to work through what in that episode were primarily the technical things that I was thinking about at the time, to review what went wrong and what were the different scenarios and the different weaknesses of my technical approach to why I didn't get that prediction right, and thinking about things like, you know, the birth times, and was I using the wrong birth time for Hillary Clinton? Was I even using the right birth time for Trump? And all that other stuff. And I was not sort of at the point where I could deal with this other issue that people were bringing up, which was bias and what role bias played in either my prediction or everyone's prediction at that point. But I think over the past few weeks, I've gotten a better sort of handle on this. And I think that is the access point. And I think that is the way in which bias did play a role in so many astrologers getting it wrong in this last election, which is that in the media, and I feel like, and I know some people will, you know, not like this statement, but I do feel like in the media and just the general consensus was that it was more unlikely that Trump was going to win. And there was this presumption that Hillary would win the presidency just from a practical standpoint. And especially by the time that panel happened in October, it was like the whole, you know, recording of him sort of making those lewd remarks about grabbing women had just come out, and it looked like he was sunk, that his campaign sort of was sunk from that and from other stuff. It's like the tax return stuff had just been released. And just in general, it seemed like she would win, and it seemed more implausible that Trump was going to win at that point, in sort of early to mid-October. And so I did go into that with this sort of presumption that things were more weighted in her favor from a practical standpoint. And so what that did then was it made me look at some of the negative things that were there in her chart and sort of weight them less than I would otherwise, and just assume she was going to get in, because it was indicated, basically she was in the zodiac releasing period. She was in an eminent period, extremely eminent period of her life, but it also switched over into an extremely difficult period of her life where that Mars-Saturn conjunction was activated in her 10th house. So for example, she was like in a 10th house perfection year that she switched into right before election day. And so it's emphasizing the 10th house. It's emphasizing her career and her social standing and eminence and everything else. But then it's also activating that Mars-Saturn-Pluto conjunction in the 10th house. So my presumption then with this sort of waiting was, you know, she'll get elected, but she's going to, you know, have some really tough times. And it's not going to be a very pleasant experience necessarily, especially that first year will be one of the more difficult years in her life, which had some sort of bearing on past times that she'd been in 10th house perfection years and sort of similar things had happened. So there was a sort of weighting that went into that, that was a sort of practical bias in some sense, because the practical considerations of what was going on in the world at the time were influencing, you know, my perception of the astrology and how I was interpreting the placements. And then at the same time, that was leading me to look at some of the things that you might look at in Trump's chart that indicated that this was a time of eminence or that he could win the presidency, and to sort of weight some of those lower than I would otherwise sort of normally. And to that extent, it's like the charge then of bias is valid, but understanding, you know, what was happening at that point in time and understanding why all of the astrologers or most of the astrologers would have waited or would have altered their predictions, because I think it's safe to say that the general consensus was that Trump wasn't going to win, just from a practical standpoint, or was unlikely that he was going to win, or that the percentage was very low, was the sort of general consensus at the time. I mean, it didn't even seem like, and I know this is debated after the fact, but it really didn't seem like Trump himself even thought he was going to win, because when he came out that night to give the acceptance speech, it's like he had, you know, pretty small, not very extravagant room to give the acceptance speech. Whereas when you switched over to Hillary's camp, she had this like huge like ballroom in New York that had like a glass ceiling and like would hold like tons and tons of people, and it was obviously really set up to give an acceptance speech. Whereas when he switched over to his, it was like a pretty small room that seemed like, you know, they weren't necessarily anticipating that they were going to take it. And I know there's been conflicting reports sort of after the fact about whether he did or did not think he was going to win, but it seemed that even his camp to some extent wasn't fully anticipating it. So, I mean, it's just something I've been meaning to bring up because it's something I've been thinking about over the past few weeks in terms of the extent to which, you know, astrologers do take into account practical considerations in terms of, and let that affect their predictions and whether that's right or wrong or whether that is necessary. And yeah, just the sort of effect that that has.
Yeah. Well, I think to a certain degree, it's inevitable. Like you said, it's, if you know whether you have to first concern yourself, whether it's the chart of a human being or a turtle, right? And so you're already, you know, you're looking at a different set of events for a turtle or a human being. So, you know, to do really good astrology, one of the things you need is cycles, and you need to plug history into cycles, right? So if we want to know what the Venus retrograde in Aries is like for a person, we look at when it happens every 8 years. And once the person has some years behind them, we get a number of useful precedents, and then we can really predict what kind of, and then if we know where they are now coming into that, then we can make some really on point predictions as to what that's going to look like. Right. And so the more data we have to plug in, the better the astrology works. You know, I think that it would be nice if there was sort of astrology in the void, you know, like there was this, like we could just go on instruments, but I think the turtle analogy or the turtle situation is pretty good and pretty illustrative because we have to know what we're talking about first. Is this the chart of a nation, the chart of a man, a rat, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's no getting around that. And there's no getting around the fact that we're human beings and that we want some things and don't want other things. You know, the idea, like there are some people who are terribly, ridiculously biased. But all of us have a bias. We all have a position. And in as much as, yeah, we all have a position and certain things are favorable or desirable and some of things aren't. And so, you know, even admitting bias doesn't mean it goes away. Doesn't even have to be bias. It's just like from my window, I can see this part of the street. From my neighbor's window, you could see it from a different angle. And so, you know, these things will always be part of any prognostication or even any commentary or interpretation of current events. But what's funny is that they're being, you know, bias is being bandied about as if it were something terrible that only some people were guilty of, right? Which is kind of absurd.
Right. And well, and that's such a hard thing also because, you know, it's true that the politics of the astrologer, especially if the astrologer tends towards extreme ends of the spectrum politically, will influence how they're reading the chart. So it's like, you know, I'm just thinking about some of the different news stories over the past year. It's like some people think, you know, if you buy some of the news stories that like Hillary Clinton was like running a child sex ring or something like that, then you're going to interpret the chart through that lens. Whereas if you view it through other stories that she's like does humanitarian work for children, and that's been part of her MO since, you know, she wrote her college thesis on that or something like that. And then you would interpret the chart through that placement. So it's not that an astrologer's politics doesn't influence, you know, how they're going to interpret the chart. And it certainly does. And that becomes even more of an issue now as politics becomes more divided. But as we're dealing with things like fake news, which, you know, becomes an issue in terms of if an astrologer is, you know, the astrologer is going to form their opinion of how that person is using their chart and how successfully or unsuccessfully they're manifesting different placements in a constructive way based on what they read about the person. And if your only access point for understanding the person is like what different news sources say, either in the mainstream media or in like fringe media, then, you know, there's the potential for developing a skewed picture of that person and a skewed understanding of their chart, you know, from that perspective alone, which is kind of an issue. But there's also just this other separate issue of that's also going to affect your weighting of if you're trying to tabulate all the positive and negative indications that are happening in that person's life at any point in time, it's going to affect your weighting of that as well. So, yeah. And then of course there's other things. I mean, I'm still waiting to find out how two major things will work out in both of sort of Trump and Clinton's charts over the next year. Because the other thing that threw me off, of course, is he has that loosing of the bond, which usually indicates, my keyword for that typically is a major career transition that starts December of 2017, December of this year, and lasts until early 2020. And part of my sort of overall prediction at the time, or the thing that led me astray, that was one of the biggest technical things, because I didn't understand how he could win the presidency if it was indicating a major career transition that only started like a year after he became president. So that's still one that I'm going to be waiting around for a while to figure out what the hell that was about and what that indication ends up coinciding with in his life. And then there's another one coming up for Hillary in like June. It's a loosing of the bond that connects back to that election day, and that entire month of the election was like a foreshadowing of what I call a foreshadowing period. And it comes back suddenly, and she has what's called the loosing of the bond, where it indicates some sort of career transition between June 8th of 2017 and July 25th of 2017. And it's like something that happened, because it's repeating the same period that she was in when she lost the election in November. And there's something that happened in November that almost happened, but then like comes back, or that it set a foundation for, and then it comes back between June and July of this coming year. And I'm really curious what that's going to be about, because it's almost like there's something unfinished from the election for her until that time. And if you go back and listen to the forecast episode that you and I and Kelly did right before the election, I was actually bringing that up about Trump's chart, because he had a lower level version of that on election day when he was in a foreshadowing period on election day. And then there was a low level loosing of the bond that happened later in November. And I said, it was like, there's something about the election day that might not be finished for him until later in the month. And that actually ended up being some of the final votes didn't get tallied until that loosing of the bond happened at the end of November. And then it was fully certified that he had definitely won that state. And that ended up being like the final state or something like that. So yeah, there's still a lot of things up in the air about that. And even though that was kind of a long digression, it's one of the things I've been thinking about and still sort of pondering over the past few weeks. So I meant to bring it up. Okay, so maybe it's time, unless there's anything else we meant to get to, maybe it's time to switch to the forecast.
That sounds good.
All right. So we open up the month at the very beginning of February. Probably the very first thing that I would point to would be that Venus ingresses into Aries on February 3rd. Would you say that that's like the opening thing that month?
Yeah, I think that's really important. So it's important for two reasons. One, that Venus is going to be in Aries a lot for this coming season. And so this is the opening move here. This is our introduction of Venus into Aries. Venus is going to get to about 13 degrees of Aries and then station retrograde in early March, and then come all the way back through those first 13 degrees and then back into Pisces, and then turn direct and then go through all the way through Aries again, right? So that's not just, oh, it's Venus in Aries for, you know, 4 weeks. Like, this is the introduction to a lot of Venus in Aries, right?
Right.
So there's that. And then the second thing is that when Venus ingresses into Aries, Venus will be joining Mars there.
Okay. Right.
And so actually, as we're speaking on the 27th, Mars is, I don't know, 4 hours from ingress into Aries. And so what's interesting, so what we know is, one, Mars rules Aries, and so Mars is really strong in Aries, and both Venus and Mars will be in Aries with Uranus for all of February, right? And so that's not only do we have sort of greater weighting of planets into Aries, we have the ruler of Aries there, we have Mars there, right? So this gives February a much more Aries-like quality. I was going to say Arian, but that could be confused. And so, you know, we're looking at Aries qualities. We're looking at fast, impatient, brave, bombastic, explosive, intense, you know, quick, spiky sine waves of like big exertion and then exhaustion and then big exertion again. You know, I guess when people say it's go time, right? That's that Aries is go time,
right?
And we have a couple moments where that comes to a head. But you know, that both Mars and Venus being in Aries, which everyone will be able to see in the sky. If you look out, when the sun sets to the western horizon, you'll be able to see both Venus and Mars in Aries. That's a big part of what gives February its character.
So there'll be, yeah, because I've been seeing that. I mean, it's been really striking for a while now, how you could see Venus. I guess it's mainly been like in the evenings, like shortly after sunset, you can see Venus and Mars right now in the sky pretty close together. And that's going to continue.
Yeah, they're only about 5 degrees apart right now. So one thing that's interesting, for a couple reasons, is for the last couple weeks, if we look at it, it looks like Venus has been gaining on Mars. Like Venus is going to catch Mars.
Right.
And if Venus wasn't gearing up for a retrograde cycle, that would be the case. Venus's average movement speed is much faster than Mars. But Venus is actually slowing down and slowing down and slowing down while it pursues Mars, right? And so if you look through, like if you look, if you kind of watch the month go by, if we look at next month at this time, there's 10 degrees of arc between them, whereas now there's only 5. And so while Venus is usually the faster body, which catches and overtakes Mars, she's not going to catch Mars this time. And so that's really interesting from a horary perspective. If you're reading a chart, and you're looking to see if the, you know, Venus and Mars are the significators, and it looks like they're going to make a conjunction, right? This matter is going to complete itself. But that's not the case. right. Venus is not going to catch Mars.
There's a name for that. Is that frustration? Or because I know there's like different versions of Abu Mishar.
Yeah, I in my brain, I call it false application. Right. It looks like it's going to happen, but it isn't. But that's just sort of my quick version. I don't know what the traditional titles are.
I'll have to
look at that. And so that's, you know, that of course matters for horary charts, where those are important significators. But it also matters in general for the significations of Venus and Mars, right? You know, I think that there will certainly be a crop of romances that weren't, that come out of this February and March, especially February, where it looks like something's going to happen and then it doesn't. Or, you know, it happens, but in a different way and much later. And so anywhere where you're looking at Venus and Mars coming together, if it looks like, oh, it's just going to come together, great, it's on schedule, they're only 5 degrees away right now, that's probably not going to be the case, right? So, and there's, you know, again, one of the general themes, I think, for this year is curveballs and wild cards. And, you know, which... I'm getting from Uranus being configured to both Saturn and Jupiter, right? Making multiple exact aspects to both of them, right? And I think February, and then with the Venus retrograde that's coming up in March, but we're really getting into the territory of it in February. The planet won't be moving backwards during February, but it's we're getting into the stuff that we're going to be going through. Right.
It's a shadow period.
Yeah. actually, I had a thought about the shadow period that I wanted to share. So for those who are new to the idea, the shadow period is the span of degrees that a planet will transit three times during a retrograde cycle, right? So in this case, we're looking at, I believe it's 26 Pisces. Let me just look at the thing real quick. Yes, correct. It's 26 Pisces to 13 Aries, right? So if we watch Venus's movements over the next 4 months, we'll see Venus go from 26 Pisces to 13 Aries, do the same thing backwards, and then do the same thing again, right? But what I was thinking about is actually in terms of visibility, we're going to get three different kinds of light that Venus shines on these degrees. Right now, we're getting the Venus as the evening star is illuminating these topics, right? And then while Venus is retrograde, we'll get Venus as the we'll get underworld Venus. We'll get vanished Inanna. We'll get, we get no light, right? We're in the dark with it. And then after the direct station, Venus, which is on April 15th, Venus arises in the east. And then so our third pass will be morning light. So we go evening light, no light, morning light. All of those illuminating or failing to illuminate the same set of topics. Right. It's the same thing, but from three different angles, which I don't know, I thought was kind of neat.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And that is kind of, and that's true of Mercury retrogrades as well. It's true of all of them. It's looking at the same degrees from with different, under different lighting conditions.
Right. And so that one, it was 26, basically becomes one of the more sensitive degrees.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, it's like 26 Pisces, 13 Aries. And so we're already in the Venus retrograde, right now. I think.
No,
it's, are we at 26 yet?
It's like a day or two.
Oh no, we're at 24. So in 2 days.
Literally, basically, when we release this episode, or shortly before, it will be in its shadow period by the time people listen to this.
Yeah, yeah. And so anyway, but the bulk of the retrograde is in Aries. You know, if we have to pick a sign to shorthand it. It's definitely way more Aries than it is Pisces.
Right.
And so that's what a lot of the topics are going to feel like. So anyway, like you said, the 3rd of February's ingress of Venus into Aries is really important because that's territory we're going to be in for a while. And with Mars in the same sign and ruling it, it really supercharges it, right?
Yeah, whenever I see like a pile up of planets, because we do get one, especially at the very end of February, I always thought it was weird way back, because I remember in 2001 when Obama came out and announced that the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound had taken place and that they had killed Osama bin Laden. There was like a huge pile up of planets in Aries at the time in May 2nd of 2011. And it was like Uranus and Venus in Aries and Mercury and Jupiter and Mars, and the moon had just passed over all of that stuff, and all of it was opposed by Saturn and square to Pluto. I don't know, it just sort of reminded me of that, just because it's not that there haven't been pileups in Aries since then, but it's kind of an interesting multi sort of collision of different planets in that sign that I haven't seen in a while.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. And so, with Uranus having been there for years, and with Saturn in Sagittarius, there's a lot more fire, planets and fire signs, this month than there usually are in February.
Right.
And again, just Mars and Aries by itself throws off a lot of heat. And so, the positive side of that is like going out and getting it done. The negative side is getting in squabbles and dumb little fights and conflicts for no reason.
Yeah, because it really gets accentuated because later in February, Mars hits and conjoins Uranus at 22 Aries, the same time that it opposes Jupiter.
Dude, that's the cherry on top of the month. We get an annular solar eclipse and a Mars-Uranus conjunction that are almost perfect contra-antitia. On the 26th.
Okay.
Let's say if we can, I'd like to save that. for the end of the month and just do be vaguely sequential. Cause that's, yeah, that's, I mean, that's much bigger than any other event in the month, but we have a lot that leads up to that.
Before we move on, then I did look up in Abu Mashar and in Ben's book, which is helpfully titled Introductions to Traditional Astrology, Abu Mashar and Al-Kabizi, translated and edited by Benjamin N. Dykes. He has that section, and the traditional term is evidently refrenation, but Ben actually translates it because he always goes for much more literal translations. And he says that the Arabic term means revoking. So looking up again, the Venus applying to Mars in Aries, applying to a conjunction and moving towards it, but then it stations retrograde and starts moving away from Mars before it completes the conjunction. So apparently this is called revoking or restraint or objection or annulment in the different translators, depending on which like Arabic or Latin translation you use. And Ben has a translation from Abu Mashar's lesser introduction where it says, revoking is whenever, with planets prepared for application, the one of them is not available for application because it was made retrograde. Yeah, so I thought that was kind of interesting. So there, learn a new term every day. Apparently, the traditional, probably Renaissance term is refrenation, but Ben's translating it as revoking.
I like that. So one of the things that Venus can offer Mars that you see in a lot of traditional texts, and I think in particular of the Picatrix, where it's got this one section where it's like Venus can fix whatever Mars damages, right? If Mars causes hostility, Venus can bring peace to that. And so, you know, with Mars stirring up hostility, you know, Venus, you know, you have Venus, maybe people will cool down. Maybe people will mellow out. Maybe we can all just be friends. Right. And that being revoked or rejected, right? Mars rejecting Venus, I think is pretty, I don't know. It's pretty, what's the word? Evocative.
Yes. Yeah. The idea that hopefully cooler heads will prevail, and then the cooler heads sort of slow down and turn the opposite direction and get the hell out of Dodge.
Right. They're like, okay, we got to go back to Pisces.
Right. But then it gets back to Pisces, and then all you're left, and then what it finds, that's ironic because, or something, is Venus
Saturn
retrogrades back. It finds the square with Saturn when it stations around 26 Sagittarius. And we also, I mean, we noted also in the, which is kind of interesting because Kirk was asking me whether to put Chiron in the calendar for this month. And I said no, because it's not usually something we talk about a lot, but it was notable. And even though I don't use asteroids a lot, it was notable that when Venus stations direct, it's like stationing direct conjunct Chiron or something at that time, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The way that I use Chiron is that I use it almost like a fixed, or I use it with similar rules as a fixed star. Like, I don't care if there's a sextile to Chiron. But if something's right smack dab on it, whether it's an angle or a planet, I interpret it. And that comes out of my, my natal or my reading for people is that Chiron doesn't necessarily need to be a big part of every reading, but if you've got Chiron like on the midheaven by degree, it almost always has a big role in your life.
Right. And so it's at exactly 26 Pisces by mid-April, and that's when Venus stations direct, and Venus stations direct at 26 Pisces. You get this rare, or this sort of weird alignment of Venus stationing direct, conjunct Chiron and square Saturn within like a degree, which is not very pleasant sounding.
No, it's not a very auspicious point from which to move forward.
Right. I think the term or the keyword that I used in the yearly forecast last month was heartbreak. But I'm sure there's other, you know, the Chiron thing, and my general thing with asteroids is sort of like yours, but it's more, there's just too many variables. So it's like, I acknowledge the asteroids sometimes that they work and that you can see things symbolically with them. Sometimes I do think people have gone too far sometimes. And I do worry about the modern tendency to put too much emphasis on just, you know, the name that was ascribed to the asteroid having symbolic meaning, so that whatever name was given to it was the name that was it was meant to get, even if it's something wacky like the asteroid Beer, that you'll still have some sort of like symbolic correlation with that. And I do and have seen to some extent that work out with certain asteroids like Chiron. So it's not that I don't, that I completely discount them. It's just there's a point in astrology where there's like too many variables and you have to figure out what to cut and what's most important to pay attention to and look at and what's not.
Right. Well, one thing that's worth pointing out is that Chiron's not really an asteroid. You know, it's between Saturn and Uranus. It's it's a planetoid. It's part of a class of bodies called centaurs, strangely enough. And so it's not just like one, house size thing floating through the asteroid belt. It's certainly, its orbit is relatively clear. It's like, I believe it's a planetoid. So it's a little bit less one of a million.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, Ceres is like, they say it has like the mass of like all the other asteroids combined or something ridiculous like that. I might be overstating that, but it's something where
it's considerable.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't discount the asteroids, but I've been meaning to state what my general policy was, which is just that there's something to them. I've seen that. I did not decide to specialize in it because it seemed like there was already so much just dealing with the planets, even just, you know, the seven traditional visible planetary bodies, but also when you incorporate Uranus and Neptune and Pluto and then the nodes or like the Lot of Fortune or something, you're already working with a lot of variables, which in and of itself, you can extract like a ton of meaning from if you really get down to it. So I've, you know, over the past 10 years, part of my process as an astrologer has been, you know, starting from less and working my way out and figuring out just how much, squeezing as much as I can out of just the basic bodies. And then at some point I can, you know, start factoring in other more minor things when relevant. But, you know, for me, that approach works out better than the opposite approach, which I had done sort of, you know, like most, I think, modern astrologers do, which is just like you throw everything in the chart and sort of see what sticks. But the sort of issue with that is it's a little bit more chaotic and a little bit harder to do systematically on a regular basis if you're using that much stuff. I mean, there's ways around that. And for example, like Demetra has a whole system that she talks about, I think, in her book, Astrology and the Authentic Self, where her system for working with asteroids and stuff is to like focus on ones that are making hard aspects within a few degrees or something like that to certain planets and certain personal bodies as a way of like narrowing down the hundreds of potential significators that you could be using. So there's ways to do that, but it still, you know, involves working with a lot more variables than I'm sort of comfortable with, or that I think that humans can normally like take into account on a regular basis.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's generally my approach as well.
Sure.
So it's, you like know, that, look at when it's basically right on top of something.
Yeah. So it's like that digression aside, like this literally is right on top of something. And it is potentially notable that Chiron will be stationing exactly, or Venus will be stationing exactly on top of Chiron and square Saturn. And that does kind of paint or elicit a picture for April, which will probably become more relevant then. So we'll probably return to that in a few months.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, we don't even get Venus's retrograde station this month, but we get the beginning of this with the beginning of February. We get this first pass of evening light across these topics.
Right.
And then shortly thereafter on the 5th, we get Jupiter's retrograde station. So Jupiter comes to a halt at 23 degrees Libra, and it's going to be retrograde for about 4 months. Jupiter's always retrograde for about 4 months. Jupiter's going to go direct on, I want to say, the 8th of June, the 9th of June. So Jupiter will go direct on the 9th of June at 13, right? So that means that Jupiter's going to recover those 10 degrees. And, you know, one of the things that in terms of general policy that's worth stating is that Jupiter retrogrades are not signals that there are disasters unfolding. It's not a dramatic thing. It's not a big deal. It's not, you know, it's not like Mars stationing direct where it's something you got to really kind of ride out. Jupiter stations retrograde every year, stays retrograde for about 4 months. In general, Jupiter retrogrades, you know, they mean like, if, you know, if I had to say that there is a general message, it's stop trying to take more territory or cram more in and look at what you've got and look to establish greater coherence between what you already have, right? Look to consolidate gains you've made, look to, confirm lucky hits, right? You know, it's more about consolidation and coherence rather than like getting new prizes. And so it's not as sort of outright lucky as normal Jupiter direct. But it's not, it's not some foul omen.
Yeah. And that, I don't know if it's time to transition to that. But that actually coincides with my first election for this month.
Or, oh, not, great. Not
first election, only election. Did you have any before I like completely change?
Oh, no, I just had a few things to say about the phase, and which I said.
Sure. So the phase, I mean, it's tied in with that square with Pluto, obviously, in the opposition with Uranus, which we've talked about and we'll come back to later. So electional wise, so as I announced on the last episode, so from now on, because I'm no longer writing the electional column for the Mountain Astrologer magazine, we decided to change this, the electional segment, and do it as a separate, like 45-minute episode just for patrons of the show who are on the $5 or $10 tier. So Lisa and I recorded our first one late last month, which was the elections for January. We're getting ready to record the next one, which contains the elections for February this weekend, and we'll release that for patrons. So if you want to get a hold of that episode, all you have to do is sign up for the $5 or $10 tier on Patreon, and then you'll immediately get access to the download once it's available. So that being said, so we feature four elections each month in that 45-minute episode, but I've decided to still highlight one election each month in our monthly forecast. And the one election that we decided to highlight this month actually takes place on February 10th of 2017 at approximately 4:30 p.m. in the afternoon. And you should make it so that in whatever your location is around 4:30, pick a time so that the ascendant is at about 11 degrees of Leo. And that should then pretty much match the correct chart of what you should have in the chart based on what we're going for here. So here's the chart. It's February 10th, 2017. Leo is rising. The sun is the ruler of the ascendant, and it's placed at 22 degrees of Aquarius in the seventh house. And it's applying to an exact trine in a day chart with Jupiter, which is recently stationed retrograde, at 23 degrees of Libra in the third house. So one of the main things we're going for in this chart is the ruler of the ascendant is applying to a trine, which is the most positive aspect with the most positive planet in the chart, because this is a day chart. It takes place shortly before sunset, which means, according to the doctrine of sect, that Jupiter is at his most beneficent within the context of this chart. So I love the chart for that reason. It also has some other good stuff. This is basically the day of the full moon, which also happens to be an eclipse. And we had Lisa and I had some discussion about that and like the pros and cons of doing elections on eclipse dates. I know there's the literature is a little bit divided on it. I know there's some people some astrologers who think that that's, you know, a no-no and that you don't do stuff on eclipse dates. I have less reservations about that because I usually see eclipse more as important markers of time or like sort of gateways where really important events can take place and can sort of start, either begin or culminate. So I don't have sort of reservations about using elections on eclipse dates as long as they're sufficiently auspicious. How do you feel? Do you have sort of feeling one way or another on that?
Depends on the eclipse. I think North Node is way better than South Node as far as you know, an election for doing stuff or starting something. Even so, yeah, I'm worried about it. You know, traditional material is almost entirely consistent that it's to be avoided. You know, there's this issue of compromising the lights. You know, it's like, those are the luminaries. We need those. And so, you know, I think that's the standpoint that traditional writers are coming from. I would just say that I'm very careful about it, and that I wouldn't do it. That's okay. how I would say, unless there's like a really good reason, I would avoid eclipses as elections for most things.
And I agree for certain things possibly, but I guess, it's like when I have a section about this, cause the, you know, eclipses and stuff are very much tied into the meaning of the nodes, and a lot of the meanings of the nodes come through what's happening with the luminaries, since the nodes themselves are derived from the luminaries, and the nodes literally are just the points on the ecliptic where the path of the sun and moon intersect. So it's like if you were able to like look up in the sky and then draw lines that show you exactly where the sun and moon are going to go over the next few days or next few weeks along the ecliptic. If you drew those lines and then found the point where the line of the sun and the line of the moon crossed each other, that's exactly what the node is. So they're the intersection points between the two luminaries. And in the Hellenistic literature, there was this ambiguity and this sort of debate about the nodes because of that, where on the one hand, they were viewed as, you know, ominous, because that's also where eclipses take place. Because if you have the sun and moon exactly moving past each other or having their paths intersect, then that means at those times is also when the moon has a chance to move over the sun and to eclipse it. So that is where eclipses take place. And eclipses were traditionally viewed as more ominous because of the sort of in darkening or the eclipsing of the luminaries and of the sun. But on the other hand, you also had this other thing with these ideas of like, the north node being associated with ascent and increase, and the south node being associated with descent and decrease. And that was a little bit more ambiguous in terms of whether that could be positive or negative, depending on the context, with, you know, the traditional thing about the north node being bad with the malefics because it increases their maleficence, versus being good with the benefics because it increases their beneficence, versus the south node being good with the malefics because it decreases their maleficence, and bad with the benefics because it decreases their beneficence. So in that context, you ended up with a doctrine where the nodes, when seen from that light, were more ambiguous, because they could be positive in certain contexts or negative in other contexts, simply because they're primary thing was not necessarily to do good or do bad, but just to increase and decrease. So that statement aside, that's one of the reasons why I'm not as concerned in terms of, you know, either making the nodes prominent or making eclipses prominent in the chart, as long as it's something important. Because the other thing that you will notice pretty regularly in natal astrology is that, you know, eclipses can be really important markers for important turning points in a person's life. And if you're starting something really important, that's either a new venture or the culmination of a venture, you know, there's a pretty good chance you're going to see an eclipse taking place somewhere in a prominent part of the person's chart at that time. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. So, you know, we had this, Patrick and I put a lot of emphasis on that in the 2008 or Patrick put a lot of emphasis on in 2008 and 2012 presidential elections, because Obama had an eclipse, solar eclipse, I believe, in his first house just before he became president in the 2008 election. And then he had another eclipse before he was reelected in his 10th house, before he was reelected to his second term. So it's within that context that I would recommend this chart. And the other thing that I would recommend it for, especially, is seventh house type elections that have to do with, you know, exchanges between people, or sometimes in certain contexts, partnership, because the other thing about this election is that it's Leo rising with the sun in Aquarius in the seventh whole sign house. So the ruler of this, the first, is in the seventh, but it's also applying within a few degrees. So the sun at 22 degrees of Aquarius is applying to a sextile with Saturn at 25 degrees of Aquarius. So you have an applying aspect, a favorable aspect between the ruler of the ascendant and, or the ruler of the first and the ruler of the seventh. And both of them are otherwise relatively well placed. So that's a good setup for if you're doing something especially that has first house and seventh house connotations, where you have one party that's initiating something and another party that's receiving something, which is always the person who initiates the first house, and the person who receives that which is initiated is the seventh house. So traditionally, that was always applied to things like buying and selling, but it could also be applied to other things like marriage or partnership or contracts and other things of that nature. So that, you know, February, unfortunately, is not a great month for elections in general, and we actually had a really hard time, and Lisa especially reported having a hard time finding good elections for February. So if you have like a broad time frame of like the entire year or something to initiate like a major venture that you've been building up to for 10 or 20 years, then I'm not necessarily saying that this is the chart that I would use universally in that larger context. But in terms of just looking for decent elections for initiating things during the course of this month, this is one of the main ones that I would highlight. So, that's the main thing about this election, is the sun's sort of bonification through the trine with Jupiter. The downsides to the election are that Mars is in Aries in the ninth house in a day chart, with Uranus and Venus. So there's the potential for some issues in terms of ninth house matters, which could be things like travel or education or religious matters and things like that. So it would not necessarily be as great of a chart if you're trying to initiate a ninth house thing. I think it would be a decent and usable chart if you're trying to initiate some major seventh house thing, though, especially if it's something that's coming to a culmination or is a culmination of events with respect to the seventh house, because this is a full moon chart where the moon is at 21 Leo and it's applying to an exact opposition and full moon with the sun at 22 Aquarius before the moon then switches over and sextiles Jupiter at 23 Libra. But the effect of that is that both the sun and moon are both applying to the most positive planet in the chart through favorable aspects, shortly after or around the same time that they are applying to complete the opposition with each other. All right. So that's my one election I wanted to highlight for February. And then you can get the other three elections if you sign up for the Patreon tier at the $5 or $10 thing. A lot of people have signed up over the past month. So thanks everyone for doing that. We appreciate your support. And we'll be recording that next episode on sometime this weekend. So you should see it soon. All right. So back to the forecast. I mean, I think that...
So there's an eclipse on February 10th.
Yes. So right. Our first eclipse, and that's the first eclipse of the... Because we had a debate about this in August about whether the last one was an eclipse because it was so far away from the nodes where it's like some ephemerites were...
Well, I mean, literally, NASA said no part of the shadow will fall across the body and eclipse it.
Yeah.
Like, it's not an eclipse.
All right. This is funny that this is a six-month debate at this point, or five-month debate, because I was still a little... And one listener, actually, I forget what her name was, but she actually pointed this out afterwards, that afterwards I reported getting sick. And she pointed out that had taken place in your first house, like on your ascendant or something like that. And I was like, that's a good point. I will bring that up with Austin and Kelly.
Yeah, I mean, but do you only get sick under eclipses?
Do I only get sick under eclipses? No, I mean, of course not. And there could be other things going on with it, but it was an additional nice little indicator that specific lunation may have had more juice than it should have, even if it wasn't a full-blown... you know, solar eclipse, like, and, you know, the entire sky goes dark and, you know, eagles or crows start circling type ominous type event, that there may have been, you know, slightly more juice to it than there should have been theoretically. but I don't know. We don't have to argue about it. So this one, I think everyone's in agreement that this is a full blown eclipse, right?
It's a penumbral eclipse. It's one of the modest variety.
All right. But this will fit your very stringent definition.
The very stringent criteria of there actually having to be a shadow on the body visible from someplace on Earth. Yes.
Okay.
Which is pretty sure that's what an eclipse is, but you know.
But that's an interesting point in terms of what is an eclipse, because this is something that comes back to a constant issue in astrology, and this is probably the source of our disagreement on that, which is, you know, sometimes there's this distinction between what is happening visually in terms of the observational astronomy versus what is happening from like an abstract mathematical sense. And that's where that issue comes in, is it was actually technically within the like 15 degree range or whatever the abstract sort of, you know, mathematical range is for what people consider to be eclipses or how eclipses are usually calculated. But it wasn't otherwise observationally, as you're saying, something that like where the shadow was actually cast across the body of the objects involved. But I mean, to me, and that's where I get stuck on this sometimes, is that for me, an eclipse is more of an abstract thing sometimes, in that it's a full moon or it's a new moon that takes place within the vicinity of the nodes. And we both agree on that, but it's this sort of debate sometimes about whether that can actually visually be seen and the extent to which that makes a difference or not. Anyway, so this is the first of a series of eclipses that's going to take place in Aquarius and Leo, of full-on eclipses, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so this is interesting. It precedes the movement of the nodes into Leo and Aquarius. They're still in early Virgo and Pisces. They'll move in May. But yeah, this one, as you pointed out in your election, both the sun and the moon are configured to Jupiter and Uranus with this one. We have the the famous mystic rectangle in effect.
All right.
But leaving out the mystic rectangle, right? So the sun's at 22 Aquarius, so it can hang out with Uranus at 21 Aries and Jupiter at 23 Libra, and the moon at 22 Leo can see both Uranus and Jupiter as well. So one very simple thing that we can say about this is that this lunation is juicing that Uranus-Jupiter opposition. And the Uranus-Jupiter opposition is less than 3 weeks away from another exact hit, right? So we're pouring the power of the luminaries into that again, which is the Jupiter-Uranus opposition is important because it's one of our configurations that's basically going to be there the whole, you know, for almost the entire year until the second half of the last quarter or the last quarter. Well, until halfway through the last quarter, right? And it's really tight right now. So that's definitely a push, you know, whatever Jupiter and Uranus, wherever that opposition falls in your chart. If it falls, you know, near the AC/DC or MC/IC axis, well, then that's pretty important. Or, you know, if it falls on other sensitive points. So that's one thing this particular lunation does. It's an eclipse, and it's off the North Node. And so those generally tend to be additive, right? If you get into trouble with the North Node, a lot of times it's too much. You know, that's, if we look at the Vedic take on the more and less interpretation of the nodes, they say, yeah, you can get in plenty of trouble with the North Node, but you get in trouble with too much rather than South Node, not enough, right? And so, you know, if you're going to watch yourself, it's being too hungry, too ambitious, too passionate, too much, right? Whatever too much Leo is, which some might argue is any Leo at all. Sorry, Leos. But, you know, that's the idea, is, you know, North Node Leo, too much of this. That can, however, be corrective for people who maybe don't have enough of the Leonine qualities, who don't have enough confidence, who have a hard time dealing with attention, you know, people looking at them right? So it brings, we can just say it brings a lot of blood to the tissue of Leo. And although I will say that I would not get married under that election, it's, as far as eclipses go, it's pretty nice looking. I like that configuration with Jupiter.
Yeah.
You know, this is not like a scary eclipse to me at all.
Yeah. I mean, then that's exactly why we integrated it into that election, just because that close, you know, within a degree or two, trine and sextile with Jupiter really does take a lot of the edge off of that eclipse. And it also, you know, the additional sextile from Uranus and trine with Uranus at 21 Aries adds this sort of innovative or sort of refreshing sort of spark to it at the same time.
Yeah, I don't really like to mix Uranus and the moon. I'm totally a fan of Uranus and the sun, but I like to keep Uranus and the moon away from each other.
I mean, see, even just a full moon itself already almost feels like Uranus to me, because I always think of like that thing that you hear sometimes about the idea that like visits to like the emergency room get busier or something during full moons. And this is one of those things where sometimes if you ask somebody who's like a nurse or somebody that works at a hospital, they'll still be like, yeah, that's true. For some reason, full moons seem to coincide with greater periods of traffic at the hospital. It almost has that sort of frantic quality to me already in some instances to begin with. Some full moons do when they're really prominent or when they're activated, especially in a person's chart. So, I mean, to me, that's just sort of emphasizing something that's almost already there by adding an additional sort of franticness or sort of electric quality to it.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, looking at this moon, there are almost no planets in Earth or water signs. All we have is Neptune in a water sign and Pluto in an Earth sign. And other than that, it's all fire and air. Right. It's all, you know, young, active, ungrounded energy.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And this election emphasizes that more than anything much of the year, except for the only other thing that comes close is probably going to be some of that Leo pile up in like August or something, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and that'll be the other side of this. That'll be the solar eclipse in Leo 6 months yes. later.
And that'll be a righteous eclipse.
Right.
That'll be a total solar. But yeah, so this one is an introduction. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take notes. You know, I'm going to look at it and I'm going to look at the next couple weeks after it. And I'm going to see what these eclipses in Leo have in store. Right. Because they're going to be, this is, you know, the generally you get about 18 months of eclipses in the same pair of signs. And so this is beginning quite an arc. And so I like to know what the story is about as soon as I can. And so at least understanding, you know, when these introductions give you a thread that you can follow into what the plot might be about for you and collectively.
Right. So this is like the opening salvo for a year and a half or like 2 years of eclipses in those two signs in that pair of Leo and Aquarius.
Mm-hmm.
And this one's interesting because the nodes aren't even in, you know, those signs yet. Their nodes are still in Virgo and Pisces. So this is even more in that sense, like the preliminary buildup to a serious set of eclipses in those signs that'll probably become more intense once the nodes move into those signs into Leo and Aquarius later this year, I think in early May.
Mm-hmm.
So even in that sense, it's almost preliminary or like a preview of a lot of the things that are to come.
Yeah. And that's really common with the eclipse cycle. A lot of times what we have this month is we have the last eclipse in Pisces, which comes, you know, after the first eclipse in Leo. And so you get these linkages where you're finishing up the old and starting something new, you know, in the same lunar cycle. That's very, more common than not. You know, the way that the nodal cycles move isn't like, you know, start to finish, reset, start a new one, right? It's like as one thing is ending, another thing is beginning simultaneously or even earlier than the ending happened. There's a sort of, naughtiness K-N-O-T, not naughty, right. You know, not the way we call children bad, but you know, there's a tangliness, these aren't like smooth sanded down edges. And so that's a big part of February, is this like beginning one thing and ending another, but we're beginning before we're ending. Right. which is interesting, different arcs.
Sure.
And so, yeah, but this, I mean, I'm not worried. I think this, I'll probably enjoy this eclipse, this February 10th one. I think it'll be fun.
It'll be a good time. So that's, the February eclipse is taking place in Leo. So people should really emphasize or look at what sign that is, and especially what house it is. I mean, because that's really the big thing about eclipses, is what house does that fall in your chart? And that's also like a good useful factor when you're like trying out different house systems, is like seeing how an eclipse will fall in one house system versus what house it'll fall in a different. And if, you know, there's a noticeable shift, and if you see one topic coming up but not another that seems to match one house, that's like a good, pretty solid method for testing things out or comparing things. So yeah, pay attention to what house that eclipse falls in. And since it's a lunar eclipse and basically a full moon, like a supercharged full moon, typically these ideas of like a culmination or a climax of things tend to be bigger keywords for full moons. So looking for like if there's a climax or a culmination in that area of your life that matches the house that the degree of the eclipse falls in. So at 22 Leo.
Yeah. And, you know, this is another thing that's interesting about this, with it being 22 Leo. It's one of a bunch of stuff that happens late fire, in late fire signs. Mm. So this is one of your late fire sign things, right? And I would also say, you know, look at Leo, but also look at Aquarius. If you're a person whose chart is defined by a tension between those two, this cycle, which is opening up, is going to have a lot of adjustments, internal and external, for you. You know, one of my favorite words for what the nodes and the eclipses do is they churn, right? And churning isn't necessarily destructive. That's how you got to churn the milk, right? But you know, the nodes stir it up. They stir up the tensions along that axis. And so that's shifting, you know, this is our herald of the shifting of that churning to the Leo Aquarius axis, whereas it's been bothering people like Kelly and I, who live on the Virgo Pisces axis, for quite some time now.
Right. And now it's going to mess with those of us who have like Aquarius rising with the Aquarius Leo axis.
Yeah. You guys.
And not to bring it back to politics too much, but because that's actually a useful and sort of relevant neutral statement that you made, it's really interesting you making that statement about churning, just because that's, you know, what President Trump now has in his chart. That's one of the most interesting things that he has in his chart, or one of the most prominent things, is the ruler of the ascendant is likely the sun, and he was born very close to a lunar eclipse. And that's one thing, whether you love him or whether you hate him, that he is known for is stirring things up.
Well, and he's right. Sun and moon on the nodes, they're right. Churning, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about the other eclipse, because I feel like we're thoroughly onto eclipses now. So the second eclipse in February occurs on February 26th, and it sees the sun and the moon at 8 Pisces. And so this is on the south node, or the dragon's tail, Caput Draconis, K2. And this is the last eclipse we're going to see in Pisces or Virgo for almost a decade. We've had a number of them over the last year and a half. I believe they started in September 2015. And so we're getting done here. So this is, you know, one final thing. And this is I think, a pretty dramatic note to go out on. So this isn't like we said earlier, the lunar is a penumbral, right? Which, even if you're in a position to watch it, it's not going to be that dramatic. However, this solar eclipse in Pisces is an annular eclipse, and the annular eclipses are the ones where you get the glowing ring of fire, right? The darkness within and without, you know, outside that ring. They're some of the most visually interesting of the eclipses. And you get those when the sun and moon, line up close to the nodes. In this case, it's about, 4.5 degrees. And so if you've got planets in, early Pisces or early Virgo, this eclipse is for you. Kelly, we miss you. This eclipse is for you. Right. It's also for me, but it's even more for Kelly. And so this is, that's interesting in and of itself, but what makes it doubly interesting is that it's the same day that Mars conjoins Uranus in Aries.
Oh, you're right. Okay. And, so 21 Aries.
Yeah. So Mars, Uranus conjunction Aries, Mars and Uranus are pretty vigorous in Aries by, you know, just minding their own business. When they team up, that's potent. And, if you do your antitia calculations, they're basically in a perfect contra antitia with the sun and moon who are being eclipsed.
At eight Pisces is contra antitia to 22 Aries.
Yeah.
And I misspoke. It's actually the conjunction of Mars Uranus just barely takes place at the very beginning of 22 Aries. So not 21.
Yeah. It's off by like maybe 15 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's a hit in any book. So what a wallop, right? That's just all sorts of, just an annular eclipse is pretty intense. And that annular eclipse is right next to Neptune. Mercury is 7 degrees away, but it's under the beams of the sun. Like there's a lot going on there. And then we have this, you know, big thing happening in Aries. And of course, because, this year we have Uranus Jupiter, opposed almost all year, Mars isn't just conjoining Uranus, it's also opposing Jupiter, right? As like literally the two planets are only 30 minutes of arc away from a perfect opposition, right? So we have Mars activating Uranus Jupiter again, hitting Uranus first and then hitting Jupiter, but they're so tied together. You're not going to get like this totally separate thing. And also, you know, if you just kind of follow the story, Jupiter, of course, rules Pisces, right? So it's quite the structure, right? And I think that people's experience of that eclipse and what happens in their lives is really going to depend on what their chart looks like, because there's just so much going on there. You know, if you've got stuff on the Aries Libra side, you're going to probably experience that primarily. If you live in Pisces land, like Kelly and I do, that's probably going to be, primary in your experience. But it's a configuration underlying the end of the month really goes out with a bang.
Yeah. This is all right at the very, very end of February, February 26th ish.
Yeah. And I would also add, so, you know, we have so a solar eclipse is basically a very special new moon, right? So the sun and the moon are both at 8 Pisces. And then in the ensuing days, the moon moves through Pisces and then into Aries, right? And so on March 1st, we've got the moon conjoining Uranus and Mars and opposing Jupiter. So that whole thing gets lit up again. Yeah, the thing about the end of February is it doesn't really, it's like an episode of a TV show you're watching where the episode cuts out in the middle of the action and you have to tune in next week.
Right.
Because early March is also chock full of stuff. We've got Venus's retrograde station the very first week of March.
Yeah.
So. That's, it's pretty action packed.
That's a great analogy. It's the episode. It's the Game of Thrones episodes that like gets really interesting right at the end. And then it cuts to black and you have to wait till next month to see the rest, how it concludes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because there's a surprise twist, which is Venus literally twisting around and going backwards at the beginning of the next episode.
Right. Well, that's interesting also because that's a thing that almost looks like it's going to promise some help or some aid, but then it turns out when you tune into the next episode, it doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. Let's just say like good things and bad things about this. Uranus Mars, bad thing, really volatile, unilateral, upsetting the apple cart. It's as far as volatility versus stability is concerned, very volatile, right? Mm-hmm. Good things, Uranus Mars can also preside over moments of like quantum leaps of personal empowerment, like realizing you can do something that you never thought you were capable of. Mm-hmm. Right. The problem is that when you know, some people don't necessarily behave responsibly once they have been empowered, you know?
Yeah. And you're getting this opposition from Jupiter, curiously in Libra, so that there's this attempt to balance it or attempt to bring balance through polarity and through opposition or countering or setting something in direct opposition to what the Mars Uranus symbolizes. But those two things end up being at odds.
Yeah. You know, as far as looking at this Jupiter Uranus opposition, like throughout the year, different planets sort of take sides or try to mediate. Right. Mm-hmm. And this is definitely, Venus, this is definitely Jupiter, at its lowest power to reconcile and mediate, right? Mars and Aries, you know, Mars is as strong as it gets in Aries, right? Just in terms of like dignity and power, Mars in Aries outranks Jupiter and Libra. Furthermore, Jupiter and Libra looks to Venus as ruler. Oh, Venus is over there with Mars in Mars's sign, about to station retrograde with the planet has no dignity of its own in Aries, and so is looking to Mars for direction, right? So we really have Jupiter's. This is Jupiter. Jupiter will have the revenge of moderation of Jupiter will come later, but this is definitely like Jupiter's super outgunned in this particular stare down.
And it's interesting as well because the planet that's attempting to mediate would actually be like. Well, I don't know, Pluto at 18 Capricorn, which is a little off, but it's still within 3 degrees squaring all of this that's happening. And I don't fully know how this works when it comes to outer planets in terms of like superior versus inferior, but it's like Pluto has theoretically the stronger aspect over Mars, which is in superior position to, and it has the weaker aspect over the sort of inferior square going backwards towards Jupiter. So does that mean that Pluto's then, you know, empowering Mars more, or does it mean that Pluto is sort of damaging Mars or holding Mars back more? I guess it depends on, you know, who Mars is and what it's attempting to do.
Yeah, I don't know. I would say it just casts a little kind of a weird shadow over the whole thing. Like there's some creepy guy watching the whole thing happen. And then there's the fact that there's the eclipse taking place, right? Annular south node, solar, you know, that there's a huge depth to a solar eclipse in Pisces. If you want to talk about things feeling dreamlike, solar eclipse in Pisces on the south node right next to Neptune, there's definitely kind of a deep and surreal quality happening there. There's action far beneath the waves. But then there's also this action lighting up the sky, right? There's this really kind of obvious Mars, Uranus, Jupiter thing, right? That's not going to be like this, just this kind of subtle, deep psychological current, right? Like there's going to be stuff that happens, action. And so it's interesting. You have like deep stuff and really obvious stuff happening at the same time. It's a really wild mix. One thing I would say that almost all of the effects, both positive and negative, have in common is the volatility. And volatility, I don't use that as a negative term, but just that like this is not a period where things are fixed and static. Like things, you know, that which will be uprooted will be, you know, is likely to be uprooted under these configurations internally and externally. This is, you know, and there are a lot of opportunities that come when things are in motion, where things aren't just stuck, you know, where they are, right? And so I don't know, I would say, you know, be prepared to ride it. I would not plan out exactly how you think things are going to go and assume that there will be no surprises. I would do flexible planning for that last week of February rather than rigid planning.
Yeah, flexibility is a good keyword there. I mean, it one of the things that's weird when you're talking about this being the, is that that eclipse has this weird, both a sense of beginning, but also a sense of ending. So you're pointing out how it's the, you know, ending of about 2 years of eclipses in Virgo and Pisces, and it's the last one that's going to be there for like a decade or something. But then it's also a new moon solar eclipse, which also, which typically has a sense of something new or something that started or some seed that's being planted.
Right. But it's a cycle. It's a lunar cycle of wrapping some stuff up.
Yeah. It's just, it's interesting.
It's not like we're going to end the whole cycle and understand everything in the hour and a half that the eclipse takes place.
Right. I guess I'm just saying that it's ending. It's almost like the last, because it's the end of a series, let's say, if like a year and a half, 2 years. So it's almost like it's the last chance to lay that final new beginning or that inception or the foundation of the seeds of whatever part of that chart that it's part of your chart that it's falling in. It's like the last chance to lay the seeds for that, that will then grow over, you know, the course of the next decade or so, between now and whenever eclipses start happening in that area again.
Yeah, I wouldn't characterize it in terms of planting seeds. It's the South Node. It's an eclipse off the South Node. I would say it's about, if anything, it's about being, you know, the last installment in a cycle and your last chance to let go of something that was weighing you down. It's about wrapping up or resolving it. You know, it's the eliminating what you don't need, and it's Pisces. So it has a lot to do with like getting rid of, you know, feelings feeling complexes that you've been carrying around that maybe I don't need to be mad at my fifth grade gym teacher anymore.
Right.
You know, it's letting it go so you can do this new stuff. So you can move on.
And but it's still like a new moon though, in some sense. So it's setting a tone for,
right, at the very least, but that can be a theme for a lunar cycle.
Yeah, of letting go, right? But then it's something that plays out over. It's not something that happens instantaneously. It's something that then has to sort of develop after that point, right?
Yeah, I think the lunar cycle, especially up, I would say up till the next full moon, that'll be a theme. Right. Like a pretty obvious theme. And then, you know, a lot of similar solar eclipse stuff will echo around for the next 6 months, but a lot of it plays out in the next 2 weeks.
Sure. All right. Well, and I mean, that's really, it's like those two eclipses especially are the big signatures this month, and the way they get tied into some of those other configurations, like the Mars Uranus conjunction opposite Jupiter and everything else.
Yeah, I mean, pretty simple. It's two eclipses and a bunch of stuff in Aries.
Right.
Right. That's the short version, which is not, really doesn't mutilate things too badly. Like, that's basically the deal.
And I mean, there's a bunch of other like little minor ingresses, like the sun. So Mercury ingresses into Aquarius, or it's not Aquarius, is it? It's February.
Yeah, it does that on the 6th.
Okay, 6th or 7th. Sun into Pisces, February 18th, Mercury into Pisces, February 25th.
And just in time for the eclipse.
Right. And that's about it for the month, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, other than Mercury changing signs, it's stuff in Aries, two eclipses.
Right. Because Mercury is going to be cruising all month because it's getting close to or moving up to the conjunction with the sun, at which point it's moving the fastest when it's direct and conjoining the sun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get a superior conjunction in the first week of March.
Okay, got it. Well, we'll save that for next month. All right. Well, I think we covered all of the major alignments that we wanted to cover for February. I highlighted the one eclipse that I'm recommending for this month. Although we'll come up with three more this weekend in the forecast episode for patrons. Is there anything else either astrologically or news wise or like personally that you meant to mention?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, I think that's brings us to the end of this. Then I'm going to be, you know, made all the announcements earlier. Hopefully I'm looking forward to seeing a lot of people in Baltimore in February. If you're going to the NCGR conference in the middle of the month, if you do attend, then come up and say hi. We always love it when, you know, meet new sort of listeners of the podcast at these conferences. I think Kelly's going to be there as well. Austin, you're taking a rain check on this NCGR conference, but you're going to come to NORWAC probably later this year, right?
Yeah, correct. I have writing to do this month.
Got stuff to do.
I got fancy astrologer stuff to do.
Right. Where we'll just be drinking and attending lectures and hopefully signing books and things in Maryland, in sunny Baltimore in February. All right. Well, I think that brings us to the end of this. I'm sure there's things that I meant to mention, but I can't think of them at the moment. Doing the giveaway on episode 98. So that's going to come up pretty soon. I'm going to start resuming doing normal episodes again, either later in February. I wanted to do a few episodes and I wanted to talk to you at some point, Austin. I don't know that given your schedule, that I can get you to come on more, but at least throw some ideas of things that you think would be good topics. I was thinking about doing one on like self-publishing, because going through this process over the last year has been interesting. So I was thinking about having my editor, Aaron Cheek, and my layout person, Shannon Garcia, on to talk about this sort of revolution that's taking place in terms of astrological publishing and how a lot of astrologers are moving to self-publishing and some of the things that are involved in that. But that's actually, you know, something that you've done to some extent as well, right? Because you've sort of followed that path and you've been publishing your almanacs or you were publishing your almanacs yourself for several years, right?
Yeah, I think I did the first one like 6 years ago.
Okay. So you were sort of at the forefront of that in terms of astrologers taking advantage of new technologies in order to move in this new direction. So I was thinking about doing a show on that, thinking about doing a show on the book in general at some point to help promote it and talk about all of the work that went into it over the past year. Kenneth Miller wants to do a show on the Age of Aquarius at some point that we've been putting off for like over a year now. So a few topics I've got floating around that hopefully we'll get to in the not too distant future.
Yeah, those sound good. I think self-publishing is really important for a small field like astrology. You know, it's important generally speaking, but I think it's especially important for us. So I'd love to hear y'all talk about that.
Yeah, it's just a really interesting area.
Quick recommendation, if you could get Ben Dykes on. Ben has published a lot of great material himself.
Yeah, that's a really good idea. That he's a great, because I've been asking, I just called him yesterday to get some more advice about publishing and like print times and a bunch of other stuff, like using Amazon and what the deal is with hooking up the printer to Amazon and how long that takes and everything else. So he would be a great person because he's published like 20 books now through Amazon or through his own self-publishing company. And he's got like two or three more that he's finishing and should be coming out in the next few months. So I was actually going to interview him because he's just translated a new version of Dorotheus of Sidon, which is actually amazing. It's something where you would think, like normally that sounds like it could be kind of lame in the sense of that, you know, we already have a translation of the Arabic of Dorotheus, but in fact, Ben has gone through and done a whole new translation and he's found a bunch of errors in David Pingree's translation, including major ones like calculations of certain lots, where in Pingree's English translation, it says to reverse the calculation. But then when Ben looked at the Arabic, it doesn't say anything about reversing it. So that's a pretty big deal in terms of him working out and clarifying and correcting some errors in that. And then he's got a few other translations by Theophilus of Edessa and like a bunch of other stuff, Soliban Bisher, that will be coming out shortly as well. So he would definitely be somebody I want to interview about that and see if I can slip in some publishing questions at the same time. All right. Well, I think that's it then for this episode. Where can people find out more information about your work?
Oh, people can find me at austincoppock.com. That's AustinCoppock.com.
Awesome. And my website is chrisbrennanastrologer.com. The podcast website is theastrologypodcast.com. And if you like the podcast, of course, be sure to support us through Patreon. Be sure to review the podcast on iTunes, since that helps other people to find us. And thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.